And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast Live from a studio in downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin. One of the cool studios. Now I feel cool because it's one of these window studios where I look out on the outside world, except no one is stopping to look at us like they do when they do like the ABC News. Everyone's like, oh, there's a weatherman. I want to look at the weatherman. No one cares that we're here. Chris Herring of 538 Midwesterner is here in Milwaukee with me. How you doing, sir?
Really good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm hanging in. Life is treating you well. NBA, we're almost halfway through the regular season somehow. 30-plus games in now.
I'm starting to learn that every year is fun for me, for whatever reason. It's been when you kind of recap just the week-by-week happenings, I know Rachel does that a lot on The Jump, where she'll just kind of take you through and almost like a refresher because you can forget with how much stuff happens. Obviously, last week with the trade that wasn't a trade and then kind of was a trade. There's just so much stuff that I enjoy it. There's so many people that will tell you it's not fun when you know how it's going to end. And, you know, maybe TV shows are like that. I don't mind the lead up. There's always something crazy that could happen at the end.
Do you not know how it's going to end, though, this season?
Do you feel like
you don't know how it's going to end?
I have a hunch. What I will say is I feel probably more firmly than I have in past years that it seems like I have less questions about the Warriors coming out of the West than I had. Obviously, last year, I felt like there was a chance that they could lose in the West last year, and obviously going to a Game 7 proves that that chance was valid.
Interesting how many people would disagree with that, by the way, who would disagree that even down 3-2, it was inevitable. I remember fighting back against that at the time, just in the sense that the idea was that it was all the Warriors getting in their own way and that the Rockets had nothing to do with it. Now, once CP gets hurt,
exactly,
then there is a certain, you know, inevitability. But I'll tell you, like, you look back and look at everyone's tweets from the first half of Game 6 and the first half of Game 7. The Warriors were literally taking craps all over the floor and couldn't get a rebound, like, no, there weren't that. Now, you would get people saying, here comes the third quarter, we know what they're going to do. But, like, there was a fair amount of, like, serious people who were like, oh, this is interesting.
I mean, it took them missing 27 threes in a row, you know, a historic sort of cold spell to really make you feel good about the fact that the Warriors were, in fact, going to win that game. So I it's kind of strange to me how we gloss over that, the idea that this was such a cakewalk. I think we tend to remember what happens last. And so, obviously, they swept the finals. But, that was a series. Chris Paul getting hurt, people kind of, you know, checking every 5 minutes to figure out if he's going to be able to play Game 7, because I think in a lot of people's minds that would have changed the perception of whether or not we felt like the Rockets could win that game or would win that game.
And in fairness, Andre Iguodala was also hurt.
Sure.
The story, this is not what we intended to talk about, but we will talk about what we intended to talk about shortly. If I had a wish for something in the last 50 games of the season, it would be for one of these Western Conference teams to rise up.
Exactly.
And look like, okay, this is a serious team. Because Denver is number one in the West. They can't beat the Warriors. I'm sorry. The Thunder are 19-10 and have the best defense in the league. I just think player for player, it's just not close. And they can't seriously compete with the Warriors in a 7-game series. The Lakers are two guys short. Like, I just don't, I don't know if it takes a trade, if it takes the Nuggets getting healthy and like, oh my God, they look amazing. Like, I don't even really see that. I don't know what it is. I don't know how I can wish it into existence. Can we wish it into existence?
That's what I was getting at. I feel like you actually have teams capable of pushing them a little bit. I just don't think any of them are in the West. And I know from tweets that I was getting from people this past week,
people, sounds like a reliable source. Tweets I was getting from people.
Because I'm part of the weekly power rankings that come out every week. Me and Kevin Arnovitz and Mark Spears and a couple other people. And I was taking flack from people because of the – well, I guess we all were. But they felt like Denver was ranked too low in the rankings. And they were like, they're tied for first in the West. They have – you know, they're first in this. They're first in that. What was it? Rebound percentage. They're one of the top five defenses in the league. They've got the best record against all these good teams. They basically knocked off every one of the seeds like 2 through 7 or 2 through 8 in the West. They've beaten Toronto twice now. And so it's like, what more does it take for us to get some respect? Because they, you know, they've been playing shorthanded. There's been no Barton. Obviously, Millsap is gone.
Gary Harris.
Gary Harris has been out now for a while. So I get where they're coming from. And part of it, honestly, is the fact that I don't see a team that hasn't been in the playoffs all of a sudden being able to kind of stand toe-to-toe with a team that's played in four straight finals. So I don't know. Like you said, maybe it just kind of takes them really getting even stronger once they get back to full health. But I think that the team, the top three or four teams in the East would all pose more of a threat in a series against Golden State than any of the teams in the West. And I hope that that changes just because we're used to seeing a team in the West, push them a little bit, or at least we think that those teams can push them. We thought the Spurs that one year, if Kawhi didn't get hurt, maybe could have done it. So a team doing, kind of getting at least in a rhythm to where the Rockets were last year is kind of what I'd like to see out West. But I don't know. They beat up on each other so much.
Maybe it's the Rockets who have won 4 in a row and are now a game over 500.
Maybe.
I mean, I don't think that. I just don't know. To me, the Thunder are the second best team in the West. They are the team that I thought they were going to be last year before they acquired Carmelo Anthony. And if you look back at what I wrote, I picked Houston to finish second in the West last year. It turned out they finished first. And I wrote in picking that before the Melo trade, I was going to pick Oklahoma City to finish second in the West. This is the team that I thought they would be. Jeremy Grant has been fantastic, making up for the fact that Patrick Patterson cannot make a shot from anywhere on the court. Dennis Schroeder has been great. Like, that's turned into a really great, Sam Presti waved his magic bad contract wand again and came out with something that's helping their team. Adams, We don't talk about Stephen Adams enough. We do. 50% of it tends to be in a sort of comic vein of, like, he's impervious to injury. People just bounce off of him. People punch him in the groin or kick him in the groin. It doesn't seem to affect him. The guy is just good. The guy's really good. Gets better every year. It's just it's the Warriors are anomalous. They're just anomalous. And when you line up player for player, like, oh, Hamidou Diallo's giving them good minutes. Dennis Schroeder, Alex Abrines off the bench. Yeah, the other team has Klay Thompson. The fourth best player on the team is Klay Thompson.
Yeah.
It's not fair.
I probably owe them more credit than I've given. I'll be honest. I felt like they had the potential to get to that place where they were. I actually, I think, said last year as a prediction, I thought they'd end up with the best defense in the league last year. And obviously they've been without Robertson. I didn't write them off necessarily as being, you know, a team that could make some noise out West. But I figured that once Robertson didn't come back from his injury, and I think he's now had two setbacks with that injury, I figured there, you know, that's probably one of their best players if he's healthy. The fact that he's not there, and the fact that I didn't trust them that much on defense without him, missing him for big chunks of the season, that I like I said, didn't write them off, but didn't feel that great about them. The fact that they've done this without him, and the fact that they've also kind of been hot, where they had such a slow start to the season, where they weren't the last team to get a win, but they were one of the last teams to.
They
pick
were 0-4, I think.
They're a lot more legitimate than I think I was giving them credit for at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, Russ has been, to his credit, Russ's usage is down. Now, he can't make a shot, but his usage is down, and he's playing the way they need him to play. Paul George, as I am fond of saying, is a boss and has been a boss this season. It's interesting, the idea of Roberson returning both makes me nervous and doesn't, because he is such a non-shooter that they have the best defense in the league. He will make them better defensively, and frankly, if they have George, Grant, Robertson, and Adams on the floor, they kind of get terrifying defensively, and they can even play Grant at center. It gives them more leeway to play Grant at center, which I think is an interesting end-of-game lineup for them and something they've done here and there when Adams is – the game gets too small for Adams. But – and it's not as if they're getting shooting from, like, Terrence Ferguson. And it's not like they're getting shooting from these guys, so it shouldn't make me a little uneasy. But they're rolling so much that it just it's a net good thing for them if he comes back, and especially if he's healthy by the playoffs. But I do think it will make for some interesting quagmires for Billy Donovan to navigate.
It's interesting because you normally – at least I normally don't think of guys like that as being the ones that would – potentially be a problem when you reintroduce them to a lineup. I think about the guys that are well, this is probably too big of a departure, but when I covered the Knicks and I watched the Knicks try to bring Amari Stoudemire.
I knew he was going to come back to Amari.
Back into a series against the Pacers of all teams, you know, the Pacers that were like a top defense in the league, Pacers. And I think of high usage guys as being the ones that I worry about more, but you're right. When the space is already kind of a little bit dicey sometimes with this team, that you introduce someone in there that you can ignore even more. And I think that gets in his own head a little bit. So that's also part of it, too, is that, I mean, you're not worried about him being out of rhythm as a shooter because he's always out of rhythm. And it looks like he's afraid of getting fouled sometimes, too, around the rim where he just won't take certain shots. So that does become interesting if teams can ignore him even more, which, you know, I didn't even think was possible, but might be in a situation
It's possible. I mean, Golden State is taking it to an extreme, but I just think, you know, it's actually interesting. I think that the league is going to trend even more toward doing that. I mean, if you watch the Nets play, this is a spoiling of 10 things that's going to come, but if you watch Jared Allen play defense, he just plays a zone every game. Every game he just plays a complete one-man zone. If you have a center that's not a three-point shooter, Jared Allen is going to sit under the rim and go in and out of the lane and tag every cutter that comes through so he doesn't get called for defense. He is not going to guard his guy at all. And it's like the Nets are really interesting. The Nets do a lot of little innovative things like that, and it's not like a novel concept to keep your rim protector back. Like DeAndre Jordan plays in cement shoes at the rim and just stands there all the time.
He's been really bad lately, too, by the way.
I don't want to spoil that one yet because that's been my 10 things this week.
Oh, boy. Anyway,
I don't want to spoil that one. But the Nets are taking it to an extreme where it's very intentional and they're just telling him, play his own. And it's really – the Nets are not afraid to try interesting stuff.
Can I just tell you that I really like them? And it's weird, too, because I obviously have a lot more interaction with Knicks fans than most of the other fan bases.
You're scarred from your days on the Knicks.
It's there, and I can't deny it anymore. I tried to for a while.
They're the ex-girlfriend that just every conversation we end up going back there. Like, if it's you can't get away from it.
But the thing is, I like crediting the Nets because I feel like it may not always show up in the win-loss column, but lately it has, first of all. They've been pretty good lately. I think,
five straight?
So there's that. But I feel like at some point that's kind of bound to come for them just because. You know, analytically, they've been trying the right things, I think, and kind of experimenting with the right things. They've lost probably more close games than any team in the league over the last year and a half. I know we kind of wrote about that at 538 last year, that they and, you know, the methodology was a little bit weird, but the fact that they were getting calls missed at the ends of games more than any team in the league.
Yes, Spencer Dinwiddie is about to go well. He's very angry.
He complains more than anyone I've seen before. But he also, when we wrote the story last year, he was literally at the top of the list of guys that had been the victim of a missed call more often than anybody in the league. So I mean, just kind of looking at where their opponent's shots come from and where they're forcing opponents to shoot from, where their own shots come from. There's just a lot of stuff that kind of makes sense to me with that team, and they've got some pieces. They're still obviously more than one player away, but it is part of the reason that when Caris LeVert got hurt, that it was so frustrating, and also why it was so great to see that it wasn't a season-ending injury necessarily. But it was rough to watch initially because you're like, this team seems like it's headed in the right direction. You don't know how long it'll take. You don't know whether any of the stuff that they're doing is totally sustainable, but it's a team on the right path, and that counts for something, I think.
I think they're seven players away, technically. I think the Nets are seven players away. If away is championship contention, they're like maybe eight.
When I say away, I should be really clear here. We just talked about who were you talking about a couple minutes ago? You said they're two players away.
I don't know. Somebody. Somebody in the West.
When we talk about
the Lakers,
players away, I mean, for the Nets at this point, it's been long enough to where I'm talking about away from real uncomfortable sort of playoff level contention to where they can really scare a team.
Hey, they're three games out.
So it's not to say that they're two players away from making the playoffs. It's to say to where they really put a scare into whoever they're going to play.
They're three games out, and ahead of them are the 13 and 16 Miami Heat, who are hilarious. I love I like when the Heat play these – like their game against the Clippers last week, and they've had a couple games like that since where they have the skeleton crew. Like Hassan Whiteside was out for personal reasons. Dragic is out and on and on. And they end up playing like Justice Winslow, Derek Jones Jr., James Johnson,
Magruder,
Bam Adebayo. They're playing three power forwards, a center, and a random whatever guard is out there.
Yeah.
And they're playing the zone. The last week and a half they're playing a zone, and it's kind of working. I think the Heat have more fun. I think Spo has more fun in those games where they have like half a team and they have to junk it up and find a way to win. But anyway, the point is they're ahead of the Nets, and then it's like, do you know who the eighth seed in the East is right now?
I haven't checked in a couple days. Orlando?
Orlando tied okay. with Charlotte.
Okay.
Kemba has nosedived into a slump, timed exactly for the moment that I released my Kemba Walker profile. Yeah, the gap between teams five, this is when everyone's like, oh, the East is, you know, everyone's got to stop making fun of the East. No, the East has five good teams.
The top of the East is good.
The East has five good teams, and that leaves 10 bad teams. Bad to mediocre, and four really bad teams.
Yeah.
Really bad teams between the Hawks, Bulls, Cavs, and Knicks, who I just... It's nice to see Emmanuel Mudiay play well. Chris, none of this is what we're supposed to be talking about.
At all.
What are we doing? I'm even angry at myself because the whole point of this podcast, or one of the points of it, was you and I wanted to talk about a team that deserves a moment, after literally 15 years of gross incompetence and endless losing and DeMarcus Cousins' temper tantrums. The Sacramento Kings are 16-14,
yep.
which for a normal NBA franchise is the equivalent of like 29-1. And true to form, we discussed, let's talk about the Kings for 20 minutes. They go to Minnesota and lose by 9,000 points last night and sit all their starters and get into maybe it was not a fray about whether they should have drafted Luka Doncic over Marvin Bagley. And Dave Yeager, their head coach, says, there was an idea, passive voice. Anytime you use the passive voice, it's a giveaway. There was an idea. Who knows where the idea came from, but there was an idea that Luka Doncic had a ceiling. And unfortunately for us, he does not have a ceiling. Now, unfortunately for us could mean unfortunately for us because we didn't pick him, or unfortunately for us because we had to play him tonight when he's making the comments, or just in general. And then he has to go out of his way to then the next day say, oh, there goes my phone, say, no, that's not what I meant at all. Vlade and I were high-fiving and doing ring around the rosy when we drafted him, and you guys are all going to eat crow, baby, when we have the next Westbrook and Durant. No! Don't say that. Don't say that. Stop! Stop!
Yeah, I didn't understand that part of the comment.
Just say
at all.
You guys are going to eat crow.
It was laying it on a little bit thick.
When we have two really good players running. Don't say Durant. Stop it, Durant. You want to compare Fox to Westbrook? That's cool. Fox has been unbelievable
this
year.
He's been so much fun.
Stop. So just when we want to get ready to talk about the Kings, they do Kings things.
Yep.
Not Larry King's things, just Kings things. But you know what? They're still 16-14, and they have been a nice story. And I do think, look, they have a point differential of -1. They are currently 13th in offense, and they're down to 21st in defense, which is a problem. I do think they're a legitimately solid team. Every year we have one of these teams that radically defies expectations. Last year it was the Pacers. I think the Kings are going to hang around 500, maybe a little bit under it by the end of the year. And that is a good story, given the way their young players are playing. What has struck you about the Kings? Why did you want to talk about the Kings?
So I have a theory, and now I kind of feel like you, or maybe I might be spoiling a story that I kind of want to do. I probably have to explore it, and depending on what angle I take with it, I might have to kind of ask one of my buddies at work for some math help with it. But I'm really struck by the fact that this is a team that has basically said, and Yeager kind of said this in preseason, I don't know if he ever came all the way out and said it, but I probably looked through some of his comments from them. They aren't good in half court. They're actually really bad in half court, and we'll get into some of that. I think they're 21st or 22nd in the league in half court offense, according to Unpredictable. So when they're taking the ball out of the basket and running down the other end of the court. So 21st in efficiency when they do that, but they still try. They're like top two or top three in the league and how fast they get off a shot, no matter what the situation is. When they're taking the ball out of the basket, when they're getting the ball off a miss, when they're forcing a turnover. So they're rushing the ball down the court. But, you know, some teams might start a game that way. They back off a little bit or take their foot off the pedal. They're doing this for basically the whole game. And to me, what it kind of looks like, the other thing that really strikes me about this team is that they, I think they have the best record in the league in clutch scenarios so far.
Ooh, I didn't know that.
So what's really fascinating to me is that, and this is my theory and maybe what I'm blowing my idea on to talk about on your podcast, is that they kind of look like they're tiring teams out. They get to the end of a game and they're kind of like the young boxer that still has some stamina left at the end of a fight. And other teams don't, and they end up winning games that way because they don't take their foot off the pedal with their offense. And they're efficient enough to kind of pull it off, and their defense gets better. And that's the thing that I'm wondering is that how much of the fact that they do well at the ends of games on defense is kind of, can you attribute to the fact that they're tiring teams out? They can't play at that pace. So I don't know how much of that is true. Also, it doesn't always work. If you watch the game last weekend, they played against the Warriors. It looked like Fox was dead tired. He was short, I guess maybe not short-arming, but you know, it looked like his legs weren't really under him at the end of that game where I think he had a couple of turnovers and was like 1-4 or 1-5 in the last 2 minutes of that game. And so, you know, it's going to backfire. It's obviously going to backfire at times, but that's really fascinating to me, just kind of that this team, the way they're playing and the fact that it's not just that they play with certain lineups, they play fast. They play fast pretty much all the time, and they really don't slow down all that much in second halves when they're much better in second halves. They're negative by kind of a mile in first halves of games, but they're positive in both the third quarter and the fourth quarter.
Yeah, they have some indicators that maybe a fall off is coming.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%.
Like, they shoot not enough threes and too many mid-range shots, and they give up a lot of threes.
You want the biggest indicator of how I know they're probably going to fall off, or at least one person? Bielitsa is shooting almost, I think he's like 50% almost from three. I think he's at 49%, which is better than he's shot from the field in any season so far.
They are shooting their off from three as a team. They're third in the league in three-point percentage.
That's not going to stay that way.
Well, you know,
certain people aren't going to stay as hot as they are.
They're like number, you know, if you look at the tracking data, they're like number two in wide open threes and number one in open threes, which are slightly less open than the wide open ones. They're hitting everything.
26% increase from last year, year over year, in terms of how many more threes they're getting.
And defensively, they allow the wrong kinds of shots,
yeah.
But they're not getting particularly lucky. But it just now to their credit, they've played a schedule that has been heavy on road games. They played 13 at home, 17 on the road, and they've played
ninth in strength of schedule.
So I do think that some of what they do is legitimately problematic for teams. But that's why I said I would, if you asked me to call their record right now, I would say 39-43, something like that. Like, I think they're going to hang in and be a pain in the ass and not make the playoffs. And already they're ninth. I mean, it's 16-14 in the West. They're ninth. They could be 14th tomorrow, or they could be third. I don't know. But I do think they're legitimately good, like legitimately solid.
You'd pointed out too, I think in your last 10 things column, that that the problematic lineups that they had when they're playing two bigs, particularly with Bagley. So when they play him and they're playing him at power forward and kind of anybody else at center, that it's gotten him into trouble. Now he's out for a while, and so you wonder if maybe that – well, not wonder, but that'll cut down on some of those lineups, which they should be trying some of them to some extent just to try to see what all they have.
That people took that as unilaterally Bagley just needs to play center. And I didn't even – I mean, he should play more center, but – the Kings are correct that you throw a rookie center to the Wolves like that, it's not going to go well. And they're right to try lineups with him and Cauley-Stein and him and Giles or whatever, provided they have enough shooting around those guys.
Exactly.
And I like what they've been doing lately, which to me, the interesting question about them is lately with Shumpert has been out and they've been playing Bogdanović and Hield together at the two and the three. And the Kings are one of those teams who are obsessed with like, well, we don't have a real three. We need to get a three.
Mm.
Shumps are three, but he's a fake three. Hield and Bogdanović are, you know, just, they're just not, the length is not going to be there. And I just, the numbers with those guys and Fox.
They can shoot.
Those three, Fox and those two guys, they're like, I got to look it up again after last night's debacle, but the last time I checked, they were like plus 11 or something
they
per 100 possessions.
And they're not, I mean, Shump's issue, and like you said, he's been out for a couple games now, but his issue for me has always kind of been that he tries to do a little bit too much sometimes with regards to, you know, handling the ball and convincing himself that, you know, basically that he should be Fox sometimes. I mean, Bogdanović was big for them to get back, I think. And I saw a stat the other day, which it wasn't anything that was crazy, but it just kind of was eye-popping to me. And obviously early in the season because he missed time at the beginning of the year as well. But I think it was in NBA history, guys that have averaged 15 points a game and then posted an assist percentage of better than 18 and a turnover percentage of 8 or less. And it was like Bogdanović this year and like Michael Jordan twice in his career. And that was the list. And I mean, it's a random stat, and it's one of those very random.
And he's it's one of those things where he's barely meeting the threshold.
He's not even meeting it now. I think he's at 14.7 per game now. But still interesting, and just kind of obviously somebody like that, someone that can shoot, someone that can create a little bit for himself, and doesn't play outside of himself too much, especially for a young player. You take guys like that, and that's kind of what I think they have is that they've got guys that you have to figure out how they fit, who they fit with. But you don't want to kind of pull away from lineups that, you know, the first suggestion that something may not be working right now. These guys are mostly, for the most part, all too young to kind of give up on some of these things too early because you don't know what you have yet. I mean, you've gotten some indications here and there, but you're still figuring out who meshes and who doesn't. And that's part of the fun with this team. But I am really intrigued by the stuff with Jaeger. It seems like every time the Kings have a team that is legitimately fun. And I obviously think back to the year where Malone got canned really early while Cousins was sick. Every time something fun is happening with this team, like something happens or there's some other undercurrent or storyline that comes up where you're like, they're going to ruin this, aren't they? It's the Kings.
I hope that that's not the case this year. They're actually so they owe their first round pick almost certainly to Boston.
Right.
Now. It's going to go to Boston. Theoretically, it could have gone to Philly, but it's not going to be the number one pick in the draft, so it will not. And they have $11 million, I think, in cap space. They're the only team that has cap space right now for this season, which makes them potentially a predator on the trade market. You know, you need to get off some money. We'll take it. Give us something good. And normal Kings would have like used it on a player who was injured or something, or like bad. normal team in King's position would use it to get a draft pick. these guys, the longer they hang in, the more they are going to go for it because they haven't made the playoffs in a million years.
Yeah,
and I actually think they should go for it. This is one of those things where the analytics people will tell you, no, they should get a draft pick. They should build for the future. This team isn't that good. Here's real life. Real life is you haven't made the playoffs in 15 years. Real life is you have been a laughing stock. And you know what? Real life is like, hey, we got some players who are kind of a problem. Like De'Aaron Fox can get hot for three games. Buddy Hield is shooting well from, he's killing it. Like we could, like it's not crazy that we get the seventh seed. Let's say we get the seventh seed. It's not crazy. We're coming home for game three at 1-1. And like, that's a big moment. You play for that moment. So I think they are going to go for it unless they go on a losing streak and fall out of it. And I think they'll try and thread the needle where maybe they get both future and present.
Yeah.
But they're going to go for it. And that comes back to the conversation about we don't have a three. We don't have a three. Boy, is that a loaded question for the Kings because they will sniff around threes. They will be an Otto Porter team. If Otto Porter is ever made available, which he kind of has been already, and now maybe they've pulled back, they'll be an Otto Porter team.
I don't know that I want him to go that big with something where he...
I'll tell you this. I like Otto Porter. Before this year, he slumped this year. He's mid-40s from three.
He's hurt right now, too, I think.
He's big. I'm starting to sour on him a little bit because he's always hurt. I think he's a little bit SOFT. And not as good defensively as he looks like he should be. And I'm just not convinced that healed Bogdanović versus healed Porter with Bogdanović coming off the bench, makes enough of a difference in my life, short term or long term,
to take on that kind of money,
to swallow that money.
Exactly. If it was, I mean, if we're talking about Otto Porter in his first, in his rookie deal, sure. When you're talking about Otto Porter with some of the concerns that you've got,
and it might
with that kind of money. That's the thing, is with a team that is kind of clear cap wise. I mean, to some extent, most of these guys are still young and on rookie-ish deals. Then you that's kind of an asset. Like you said, you can take on certain things. You can at least get picks. Basically, that would be an all-in sort of move, just taking on that kind of money. And he's not worth that kind of gamble.
I think your best case auto scenario is going to be like your best case Chris Middleton scenario, where Chris Middleton is going to get an enormous contract this summer.
You should.
And I think your best case and maybe most likely scenario is they about play up to the contract. It's never going to be an under market contract. And maybe your most likely scenario is actually it's like 10% overpay and kind of hurts a little bit, but he's good, so you swallow it. Yeah, the Kings are going to have a bonanza of cap space this summer, and that's scary. That's a scary thing. I feel like the league needs to embed an ombudsman into the front office starting on like June 28th and just say, we just have to be here to like disconnect the phones if Vivek tries to do something crazy.
I was initially thrown off is probably not the right word, surprised that they went after LaVine. And I mean, that they were trying to make a splash with that. The Bulls came in and obviously matched. You know, in hindsight, especially with the way LaVine played at the beginning of this year and still a young guy, maybe not a bad gamble, but like you said, you just don't. They're fun, and I actually love when the Kings are fun. I always do, and it's
great
normally,
fans. That arena is.
I love that arena. I used to. I'll be really, really honest. I used to hate going to games at the old arena. The new one is a lot of fun. It's beautiful. The fans are into it. The team is fun to watch. I haven't even been to a game this year out there. So I'm kind of rooting for them to at least stay in it. And then if they're able to do that this year, if they look this way next year, I don't want to see them blow it on like one shot on, you know, a massive contract on someone, like at least not like Porter. That would be tough, just because that you would be putting a pretty firm ceiling on this team. Just because if Fox does turn out to be a star, which, I mean, it wouldn't be a horrible gamble to say that right now. He's looked really, really good this year.
No, it's not a gamble to say that. De'Aaron Fox is legit.
I mean, he's legit.
And you know he's legit because he's shooting threes well. If you go under, he's just going up.
Yeah.
It took Kemba Walker 5 years to get to that point.
Yeah.
If you go under, De'Aaron Fox is going up and he's making it. And number two, he's outsmarting the defense. He knows what coverage is coming.
Yeah.
He knows how to manipulate it. He knows how to bait you into a different kind of coverage and manipulate that coverage. That's how you know De'Aaron Fox is good. De'Aaron Fox is going to make an all-star team someday. That dude is good.
John Schumann tweeted, it was at the beginning of the season too, but it was really cool. I always think these videos are really cool, and this is like kind of the level of film watching that I'd like to do and get to that you do and other people do, where they'll watch something and they'll notice that he'll pick up on a coverage, Fox for instance, and the first time he might misplay it or he might make the wrong read. But then they run the play again a second or third time in the same 5 or 6 minute span. And he sees the defense reacting the same way. And he baits them into doing exactly what he wants to do. And John pulled up a play exactly like that with Fox. And just kind of, that's what you want to see out of a first or a second year player. And so that's what is exciting, is that you do kind of see him, the game slowing down from him from a mental standpoint. But obviously athletically, I mean, the guy's off the charts. And he's doing some stuff that is more rooted in skill than just the athleticism. And that's what's fun about
I'm very
him.
Glad that you brought up the LaVine offer sheet, because in the wake of Doncic what-if mania this week, they began floating this, well, you know, actually, Bagley's a better choice for us because Fox needs the ball. Like, we knew that Fox would need the ball. I'm like, well, wait. Let's rewind it. You just tried to pay Zach LaVine $19 million a year. Who does nothing but have the ball all the time.
Yeah.
Number two, this idea that Fox and Doncic would not fit is absolutely insane.
Probably the best. If we're going to call Doncic a point guard, which, I mean, he obviously can do other stuff than that, that's probably the best combination you could have just because of his size, first of all, that you don't feel like you're a total – you've got a total liability-filled backcourt. You've got a guy that's big enough. You've got two guys that can pass the ball well enough. And now, like you said, with Fox, they can both shoot. And so, I don't really buy that one at all. I didn't even think about it from that standpoint.
Well, if you want to win a championship at some point,
go get the best players.
You need two awesome players who, you know, they're both best with the ball in their hands. But if Fox and Doncic can both be plus three-point shooters, which they are right now, and both be high IQ passers and be at least somewhat size differential so that they can run a pick and roll together if need be. And underrated aspect of both, they are very smart movers off the ball. They're smart cutters. They're smart give and go players. Dave Yeager runs some really good shit. And part of it is Fox, they use Fox as a cutter to score. Fox doesn't just cut to like do the Tony Parker thing of moving the offense around.
Right.
He cuts to score because he is so fast. Like, you put all that together, it's not even a question like, oh, it would take a couple of years for them to get, you know, compliment each other. They'd walk in the door and be a good fit. So I don't want to hear any of this revisionist like, oh, we knew De'Aaron Fox needed the ball. If you thought Luka Doncic was better, you should have taken him. They would have fit perfectly. They didn't think he was better, so they took Bagley, who's been fine. Let's just see how it goes.
One thing I am curious about with them, though, that I think you're right. They probably just saw Bagley as better, and it's kind of, you know, hindsight is 20/20. And Yeager, I don't know what his aim in bringing that up was, or I mean, he probably didn't bring it up. He's probably asked about it directly, but.
They were playing.
Right, they were playing against each other, and so I know it came. I'm sure it came up in a question, but the phrasing, and obviously it's going to be parsed a certain way. I do think the Kings are interesting, though, just from the standpoint of they've been beaten up for the last 5-6 years over the way they've drafted, where they will take two consecutive picks in a row with guys that are at the same position, whether it's Stauskas and McLemore, whether it was, I'm trying to think of the other guys, they took bigs in back-to-back years where they've done that too, and then they go out and they kind of compound it where you draft De'Aaron Fox and you'll go get George Hill in free agency. So they've kind of done this where they've been criticized for that in the past, where they duplicate too many of the same things. But like you said, if you have an opportunity to get Doncic, like, there's a big part of me that not just him, but I think about Jaren Jackson, and I think about, like, how they didn't go 1-2 in the first place. If you're 2 and Doncic is still there, why not? You know, I don't know. I would have been really weird about this draft in the first place, because I probably wouldn't have taken either of the first two guys that got taken if I had had the number one or the number two pick.
My point is only, don't pretend like it's a fit thing and that's why you didn't take him. And Bagley, I think if Bagley succeeded, I didn't watch college hardly at all. Bagley's been fine. Like, yep. I want to just see how it turns out. And everyone's like, well, they have all these big men and blah, blah. Well, Kufis is not going to be on the team next year.
Right.
Cauley-Stein might not be on the team next year. I think they played it right, not extending him and just like,
it'll play out.
Let's try and squeeze him in free agency.
Right.
Scala BCA is probably gone. Harry Giles is not in the rotation unless they're down by 30 at the half. So we'll see. But the Kings, it's been fun to see. And even if there's a little regression coming, we'll see how Bagley develops. I think Bagley is a nice face-up game.
He's got a really nice face-up game.
Yeah. I'm excited for the Kings. I just they have some decisions to make in terms of trades and Cauley-Stein's free agency, and I don't know if there is a Cauley-Stein team that's going to come and, like, I think their hope should be we get him back on a Larry Nance-level contract where it's like 8, 9, 10, 11 a year.
You can live with that, yeah.
Yeah, if you get up to 15, 16, then it's a problem, but I don't know who the team is unless it's a team like – I mean, Dallas is a team that stood out to me. If DJ leaves, do they go a little nuts? But that's all down the line. People, we're never going to agree on everything, but one thing we can all or should all agree on is that we need more sleep, and getting a great night's sleep, not a good night's sleep, a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think. You don't need an expensive mattress. You certainly do not need sleeping pills. You don't need to overdose on NyQuil. You just need to change your sheets. That's right, your sheets. That's why you should check out Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and get even softer over time somehow. You buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets in a store can cost up to $1,000, which seems absolutely insane. But Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple hundred bucks. That seems more reasonable. Everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews in Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, many others are all talking about Boll & Branch. Even 3 U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. Shipping is free. You can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back. You get a refund. No harm, no foul. But I doubt you'll want to send them back. There's no risk, no reason not to give it a try. And to get you started right now, my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at BollAndBranch.com using the promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Go to BollAndBranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com. Promo code LOW.
There was another team that I wanted to talk about with you that you're excited to talk about.
Yep.
That falls into our – we don't talk about them enough, so let's talk about them. Not enough has been made of the Indiana Pacers being 20-10, third in the West, one game in the loss – or third in the East, one game in the loss column out of first in the East. The team that could not win without Victor Oladipo last year could not even be competitive – went something really good, like 6-2. I don't know what it ended up being.
I think they're 0-7 last year.
Yeah, but this year they survived and thrived, and they have the number 2 defense in the league. They are on offense, they are, you know, not great, 18th average, let's call it average. How are they winning? Other than, like, why is their defense so good?
So you and I talked about this as I was coming in, and I've mentioned it in some small little write-ups I've done. They've been really, really, really good at just cutting off drives. And obviously, once guys get there, Miles Turner's been really good at the rim. I think he was like a minus 5 last year, where he's holding opponents 5 percentage points lower than their normal field goal percentage at the rim last year. This year, he's at like minus 11. Which puts him right in the top 5 or top 10 of the league. So that's been really impressive. But when you look at some of the other stuff too, like you said, it's kind of interesting that they were able to hold their own. Now, they didn't have the absolute toughest schedule while Oladipo was out, in some stretches, at least the ones where they started really winning and went on the win streak.
They got a couple injury breaks from the other team in that schedule,
right,
as I recall.
So I mean, that, sure, they've had some good fortune here and there. But that said, I mean, they were pretty unwatchable at times last year when Oladipo wasn't able to play. They obviously were 0-7 when he didn't play. So they held their own this time, which was a good sign. And that was kind of the hope with the team and with some of the roster additions they made in the summer. You hope that Tyreke Evans would kind of be able to fill that gap. So he'd been starting while...
He's not been good.
He hasn't been good at all. And so that's kind of what's really interesting about it. He's been inconsistent the way that he kind of was earlier in his career. You hoped after last year and the season he was able to put up in Memphis that he'd be able to kind of put together more consistency. And so the fact that he hasn't been that and that they've been able to win anyway has been really, really nice to watch. What I look at, the first thing I notice, and I think it's still a little bit early. I think the All-Star voting opens on Christmas or sometime right around there. But
we can now Google or something.
I didn't read the press release as closely as I should have, but it was weird. I saw that too.
I did not read the press release at all. Apologies to the NBA. I just saw Google All-Star. I assume there's something we can
do. We're going to have to talk about this and whether or not he's actually on the team. Probably not, just based on different things, but Sabonis has been really, really, really good. And when we talk about improvement from one year to the next, or, you know, over the last couple of years to now, I mean, he's been pretty incredible off the bench for them. I thought that the Kyle O'Quinn pickup for them would be a really nice one. They haven't really been able to play him because they haven't had a reason to, given how well Sabonis has played. So there have been a lot of good things. You've kind of had a Thad Young renaissance the last couple of days. I think, was he
player of the week? Player of the week.
I remember thinking, man, but then you look back at those games and you're like, yeah, he deserved it. They're on a win streak. And, you know, he's taking on different defensive assignments, just because it's been really fun to watch them play. They've been relying less. I wrote last year on the mid-range jumper that they were taking way, way, way too much. They're down quite a bit from that in terms of how reliant they're on it. They're still not taking as many threes as you'd like to see. But this is a nice team that's not quite as reliant on Victor as they were last year. Other guys have kind of shouldered more of a burden, and it's been really nice to see.
Yeah, one thing that has carried over is they play hard as all hell.
Yeah.
And they got a lot of mileage out of that last year, and there was some skepticism that they would, A, maintain that level of urgency, and B, catch people off guard with it. And I don't know if they're catching people off guard, but they play hard. And Miles Turner, you know, he plateaued, and everyone was like, well, when is the leap coming?
It's,
and I don't know that the leap has really even happened.
I don't.
Like, he's not shooting well from three. He's not. His rebounding is still just okay for his size.
Right.
He's just playing better. He's playing defense better.
Yep.
His footwork's a little better. His rotations are better. His passing, it just, it comes in such little increments where in a game you'll see him throw three of those little pick and pop, and I'm going to swing it to the corner passes, and then you'll see two games where he doesn't pass at all. It's coming, and in the last 3 weeks, it's started, and he's going to be a very good player.
That's been my issue with the Pacers, going back to the team that we were referencing earlier with the, you know, the crazy defense with the Hibbert and Lance, and they've never really struck me as a particularly great passing team. And this team kind of feels that way a little bit too, where their looks are kind of like, who can I dribble past? And so if and when they do have nights where their passing really stands out, it's a good sign, because it frees them up to do a little bit more, get some better shots. With Miles Turner, I've been happy with the defense. Like I said, they've been, I don't even think they're first in the league in terms of how efficient they are defensively on drive. They're first in the league by like a pretty decent margin when you look at second spectrum data.
On what?
Drive efficiency.
On
defensive, how well they stop drives.
Gotcha.
With how many points per drive they give up. With Turner, we wrote a story at 538 earlier this year, and I think it was the most consistent hitter in baseball history. And it was talking about Chris Davis and how I think he's hit 247 for three out of the last 4 years, or four out of the last five. Miles Turner, I was looking at it on the way in here, I think he's averaged anywhere from 16.1 points per 36 minutes to 16.4 points per 36 minutes over each of the last four seasons. So he's like exactly the same number every year. So that's not changing. And I kind of feel like a lot of times we talk about young players, generally people are looking at how much more are they scoring. And so I don't think that's the only way you can judge somebody. And that's why I'm saying
it's a great point.
The fact that, you know, that if you see incremental improvements in his passing, if you see that teams are just not able to finish over him the way they were last year, not that they were good at doing that against him last year, but those are the sorts of things that on a team scale are massive. Just because this team was already in a good spot, and I feel like they've clearly gotten a little bit better, and it's, you know, the team's different from last year just in terms of some of the faces, but they haven't even been that reliant on those new faces either, and that's a good sign given that Oladipo hasn't been in the lineup for, what was it, 11 games he missed?
Something like that. Yeah, Miles is averaging 12.7 points a game. He averaged the same exact number of points a game last year to the decimal. Rebounding is the same. Assists are up 0.3. minutes are almost exactly the same. Free throws are down. 3-point attempts are down, which annoys me because he does the thing where he pop, like, I'm not a three zealot, but you can't pop to 22 feet.
Yeah.
You gotta pop to 24.
Yeah.
You gotta pop to 15 or 24. Pick
and
one.
That was their
Don't
issue.
Pop to 22.
That was the issue last year too, is that there were just so many shots that they would take that were right in that zone where it's like, that's not a good shot, but they made them at a high enough clip to where you could live with it. And especially when you make the playoffs that way, you obviously gave a scare to Cleveland. But it is interesting because I wondered that. That's the difference to me, is if they win that series last year against LeBron and Cleveland, does the perception of that, how different is the perception of that team going into this season, even if they'd lost round two? But I just kind of feel like nobody was really talking about them. I think the smart analysts out there were kind of pinpointing them as a team to really look at this year. I thought all along, and I've written this, that I thought that they could be a top three seed in the East. I figured that the top three teams that we normally think about in this conference, you know, obviously Philly, Toronto, and Boston, I felt like one of them would get out to a cold start. That team was Boston. Will Indiana finish in front of them? I'm not quite sure of that. Obviously, Milwaukee's put themselves firmly in that conversation as well. But Indiana was just steady last year. Their offense hasn't been great this year, but their defense has been incredible. And really, when you look at the guys on that team, there's no reason they shouldn't be a good defensive team. Like, I didn't see them being a top five defensive team.
They're the power of just not playing a bad defensive player or even really a below average. Like, Collison is probably the closest thing. Collison's not good.
He's the only one I think about is not really even looking the part defensively. Smaller. Everybody else, especially when you look at Boyan, I mean, everybody in that lineup, especially when I've been watching Thad Young play defense the way he's been playing lately, that, you know, Victor, that's a team that they really don't have that many weak links on that defense.
No, Bogdanovich has been spectacular this year. If the Wizards had to do it all over again, they would just have kept him and not signed
He was really nice during some of that stretch, too, where Victor was out. And so it's been refreshing to watch them play. I'm kind of curious to see how far they take this, if they can kind of fight for a top three seed. And I don't know that will matter a whole lot with them, just that one game difference in terms of home court advantage, but they're legitimately good.
Bogey is leading the league 49% from three. Wow. I thought they would win about the same number of games they won last year.
Was it 47 last year?
Whatever. I thought they'd be functionally kind of the same, and they've been a little better. I'm skeptical that they're kind of this good defensively, and that I don't know that I would be super bullish on them exceeding that 48 wins by a huge amount, but they're a good team. They don't foul at all, which is helping. They win the possession game. They don't foul, or they win like the free points game. They don't foul, and they force a lot of turnovers. And this is the second year in a row they don't foul. And again, you don't look at their personnel. They're kind of like aggressive and in your jersey, and somehow they don't foul. Like that's a hard balance to strike. But back to the point on Turner, like he's, I don't care. I mean, I care what the numbers say, but he's qualitatively a better player.
Yeah.
And Sabonis has just been out of his mind.
Like the most efficient guy in the league, basically,
and,
at times.
You know, and look, they've played together. Let me bring it up. They've played together
100-something.
150.
It's
I just
like
had,
5 minutes a game. It's not that much.
158 minutes total. Like, I mean, they play every game.
Yeah.
It's an every game thing.
Yeah.
93 points per 100 possessions, which is, like, worse than the Jim Boylan, we did 300 push-ups last night, Bulls. And 92 points allowed, so by far the best defense in the league by that number. So there's a Favors-Gobert thing that is going to happen here where they have to decide how much can we play these two together. Now, Thad Young has been the stopgap. I believe he's a free agent after this year.
They're going to have to make that decision on Sabonis soon, too, after they just paid Turner a pretty good amount of money.
And look, I don't care. You know, I you just can't pay those two guys what Turner got, which is 18.
Yeah.
And what Sabonis is going to want, which is going to be 18. Or, I mean, if he plays like this, his agent is going to ask for the moon. And frankly, it's not crazy.
No, it's not.
Even with the center market being what it is. And I don't care. They're both young. They're both good. You can play the we'll figure it out later game. But, they are trade assets as well.
Right.
And I think that's one of the interesting shoes to drop in the next 18 months or year or 6 months, whatever it is in the league, of do they monetize one of those guys unexpectedly and just recenter the franchise around the other one? Hmm. Or do they have hope that this 93 points per 100 possession figure is malleable? The 92, the defense is impressive because Sabonis has to guard fours. And I was skeptical that he could – well, actually, I wasn't – I wrote about this. I was skeptical – that it would work in the playoffs when teams get smaller and put more shooting on the floor. But he moves his feet well, man. That dude is smart.
He doesn't have key weaknesses. And I think that's the thing about him that's really intriguing is that he would fit most teams at least for a while. Maybe not at the very end of a game if you decide you're going to go small. But, I mean, the guy just – I mean, he – you look at the jump he made from even last year to this year, but the years before that, I didn't really like him very much in Oklahoma City. I know it was
because
just,
all he did was stand behind the 3-point line, hand off the ball, and then sit there in terror, trembling that Russ was going to pass him the ball and be furious if he missed number 10.
I'm not here to beat up on Russ, but just the difference that those two guys, obviously him and Oladipo, the way they look and just kind of the freedom that they have now to basically be, I don't know if you can call Sabonis a centerpiece yet. You're not even sure if they're going to pick him over Turner, but the idea that he's looked the way he's looked.
I do think they are going to have to pick one. And maybe it's a decision they can kick the can on because they can get a Sabonis on a good contract, but I do think they're going to have to pick one, and that's
really a great season.
I'm glad you brought up this trade because I just, you know, look, you can pendulum swing every 6 months with this trade. I think it's going to go down as an unbelievable win-win for both sides because Paul George is like other than KD, is like the single best guy you can put next to Westbrook. Oladipo was not going to be that guy, and he's become something altogether different in Indiana, which is great for them. Sabonis has been fantastic. I think it's like looks that way. I think it's a great trade for both teams. I don't think you have to declare a winner. I think both teams are going to end up winning that trade.
Can't argue with that. Not at this point.
And Kevin Pritchard's going to make a run for executive of the year. And the weird thing is, like, none of these moves have really
none of them
out.
Exactly.
Like McDermott, they can't get McDermott shots. You know, one out of every three games they get him shots. Tyreek, who I thought would make a run at sixth man of the year, has been good. Aaron Holiday looks like he's going to be interesting. They're a legit good team. It's been fun to watch. This has been small market theater with Zach Lowe and Chris Herring here. We should probably do a whole podcast on the Warriors next time we do this. Any other team you want to hit for 2 minutes that we don't give enough shine to?
I mean, we talked a little bit about Denver. That coach of the year, executive of the year thing is going to be really interesting because I'm really fascinated by how many teams have fundamentally kept the same roster or rotation and are just so much better this year than they were last year. Denver, for a whole host of reasons, you know, I think Monte Morris has been a huge revelation for them, but basically everyone that's contributing something to their winning so far is someone that was at least on the team last year. And so it is going to be interesting when it comes down to the voting for some of these awards. Can you give executive of the year to someone whose team got better record wise, but didn't fundamentally get that much out of the guys that they picked up?
I think the favorite for coach of the year right now is probably Bud. Maybe.
Yeah.
Malone will get in there. I mean, the Clippers have quietly sunk all the way to sixth.
Yeah. It'll be an interesting conversation.
It's going to be interesting. Bud will be there the whole year because the Bucks are just good and they're going to stay
good. And they've changed stylistically more than any of these other teams. And I think that's generally what you think about is kind of what sort of night and day difference did we see or what really caught us off guard. Denver is a weird one because they almost made the playoffs. And the way that we think about teams when they're actually in the playoffs differs quite a bit from the teams that don't make it.
And the injuries are going to help Mike Malone's case because they're finding a way to win these games with, you know, Torrey Craig randomly hits threes for two games and Monty Morris has been unbelievable. Credit to Tim Connolly for finding him in the second round. He's been unbelievable. Like Isaiah Thomas just not going to play. Just shouldn't play.
I've been kind of saying that. I've mentioned Denver in two stories over the last 2 or 3 weeks now and I keep putting in my footnotes like, yes, I know Isaiah's coming back, but where do you put him? And if you do throw him in there, at least have the decency to do it with Morris and not. I can't imagine that they would pull Morris off the floor.
No, they're not.
He's not going to come. He's not going to not play. But even limiting his minutes more than what he already plays, I don't think you can do it because I mean, really, you look at teams that don't have point guards. I don't know. Obviously, Denver isn't interested in trading anything away right now. But I mean, like. The guy, I looked at just randomly the other day at assist to turnover ratio, and he's like 6 or 7 to 1. It's just insane how well he's played and the decisions he makes. Again, kind of like a guard version of Sabonis where he just isn't making plays that hurt you. I kind of view him as like a Conley sort of player, just in the sense he might not ever be an all-star. You know, at some point maybe becomes a starter, but he's not hurting you with any of these plays he makes. Just very smart.
Yeah, to echo your earlier basketball reference deep dive that I don't even remember who it was with. I did a Monty Morris one, and if you plug in like assist percentage greater than this and turnover rate lower than this, and I gave like a percentage or 2 percentage points threshold on each side, it's him and Michael Jordan in one season and Lou Williams in one season that have he's just been fantastic. What should we look for from you, Chris Herring, on 538?
Nothing too big just yet, but I do feel like at some point I'm kind of in love with some of these smaller market teams, at least for the time being, while they're playing well. So whether it's Indiana or Sacramento, I'd really like to kind of take a deeper look and maybe spend a couple days with one of them.
Your work is fantastic all the time. Everyone should look at Chris's stuff on 538. I read it's one of my drop everything when I see it tweeted, or almost everything. If I'm in the middle of a column or a phone call, I won't drop that.
You shouldn't.
But it's pocketed for the subway in that case. Chris Herring at 538, thank you for joining us here in Milwaukee, and we'll have to do it again soon.
I appreciate you having me as always. Thank you.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.